Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's been a cornucopia of shots and blocks and plays, quite dazzling as March Madness has turned into April days. Will UConn win not one but two? Will Tennessee rebound? Will Georgia Tech knock off another favorite? Will the sound of cheering echo from the frigid Minnesota lot? Pat Forty knows, I bet. Let's ask him and see what he's got. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Let's start with today's men's games. This evening, Kentucky will take on Georgia Tech will take on Oklahoma State. I guess we shouldn't be too surprised to see a two-seed facing a three-seed at this point.
No, you know, actually the men's tournament turned out to be fairly formful after some real early turbulence with Kentucky and Stanford getting taken out. And, you know, I think Oklahoma State probably should have been a number one seed to begin with. I think that game against Georgia Tech, a lot of people are billing that as the undercard game.
Mm-hmm.
But I say watch out for the winner of that one come Monday night.
Well, who do you like in that one, Yellow Jackets or Cowboys?
I like Oklahoma State. I picked them before the tournament started, and I just think that this is kind of their time. Their offense is better than it has been in past years under Eddie Sutton. He's a terrific coach, a wonderful coach who seems to win with guys you've never heard of every year. But I think the one thing that they sometimes struggled to do was to score. And with John Lucas being on the team now, I think that's really improved their firepower. And I really like them to come out of that game and to come out of Monday night as well.
Tonight, in the game that nobody is referring to as the undercard game, number one Duke will take on number two UConn. How do you see Deng versus Okafor and Duhon versus Gordon shaking out?
It's pretty delicious. I mean, that's about as high-powered a game as you're going to get these days in college basketball, I think. And I think that should be a real war. I think Connecticut has the better players. It's just a question, I guess, of whether they rise to the occasion. And they've done that this NCAA tournament. They've really kind of, I guess, showed the fire that you kind of wondered whether it was there or not during the regular season. And I think they're the most talented team. Duke's a wonderful team, but I'm not sure whether they have enough inside to combat what Connecticut brings to the table.
So Connecticut, UConn has shown the fire, but not enough fire to beat Oklahoma State on Monday night.
Well, that's the way I picked it going into the tournament.
I fear for my picks because they are the same as yours. This can't be good.
We're going down together, I'm sure. But I'll stick with it for now.
On the women's side, number two UConn will face Minnesota tomorrow night. The Golden Gophers are a 7 seed, perhaps because of star center Lindsey Whalen's February injury, but maybe it was a good thing for Minnesota that she broke her hand when she did.
Yeah, no, they've obviously caught lightning in a bottle this tournament and just played phenomenally. They've been really fun to watch, and they've got the momentum going. And Connecticut has shown that it's not necessarily the UConn juggernaut of old. They've been beaten this year. It'll be interesting to see how that one turns out. I have to think that probably UConn's, I guess, Final Four memory will help it through there, but that should be a lot of fun, too.
The last four women's ice hockey champions are from Minnesota. The Gophers have a chance to win it all in basketball this time around. What is going on in the land of 10,000 women's championships?
That's why I come to you for this information. I didn't know that they had won four women's hockey championships
there.
So obviously they know what to do in the wintertime up in that state.
It may, however, be the time for Diana Taurasi, Barbara Turner et al. Again. I mean, this is Taurasi's been celebrated as the player of the year all year long. Maybe Connecticut has really figured it out after some stumbles.
I think so. They look like it. You know, they look a little bit like the men's team from that standpoint. They kind of hitched and halted their way through the regular season, but now that it's tournament time, they've kind of remembered who they are and gotten that focus going on, and they sure look awfully good. And, you know, it could come down to an old money women's final with Connecticut and Tennessee yet again.
Well, Tennessee first has to get past LSU. I wonder if it'll be so easy to do. LSU was not the team everybody expected to see in the Final Four either.
No, but Simone Augustus, truly a tremendous talent. And, you know, those two teams know each other very, very well from SEC play. And again, that would be one of those where I guess I would figure that the team that's been around that block before will probably prevail just from having been there, and I think Tennessee probably is going to win that game.
And if it works out that way, Pat Summitt and Gino Auriemma just go out to half court and flip a coin?
You know, it's pretty amazing how those two keep ending up banging heads. It's kind of the extended Bird Magic run from the NBA from the mid-'80s where it's Summitt and Auriemma, and you know, I don't know. I would guess there that maybe Connecticut comes through, but it would just be, you know, it's always fun to see those two go at it because that's competition at the highest level in the women's game, and I guess it gets a little bit repetitive to see those two always at the top, but it's fun because I think that they bring out the best in each other.
All right, Pat, one final question. What do people in Louisville particularly and Kentucky in general do with this kind of a tournament? Do they pick a team to root for, or are they just all watching spring training baseball at this point?
They drink a lot of bourbon, Bill. This has been a bad tournament run for the state of Kentucky. Yeah, that's for sure. After Kentucky lost in the second round, the mourning was immense and intense, I think. But it's a college basketball state, so people will definitely watch. And, yeah, they'll pick sides, and I guarantee you that everyone will root against Duke. And I don't know why necessarily that is, but I still think that Kentucky fans have never forgiven Christian Laettner for making that shot in 1992. It was only 12 years ago.
Pat Forty is the regent of Round Ball for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and he's our college hoops kingpin here on Only a Game. Thanks again, Pat.
Regent of Round Ball. I like that, Bill. Thank you.
On Wednesday afternoon, D.C. United's players were hard at play, tuning up for this afternoon's season opener against the San Jose Earthquakes. D.C. United's first home game will mark the debut of Major League Soccer's most lavishly compensated player, who is also the league's youngest player. That, of course, would be the most celebrated 14-year-old athlete in the land, Freddie Adu. At this practice, Adu appeared oblivious to the pressure. He looked as if he was having a wonderful time. That came as no surprise to Arnold Tarzi, the first coach to work with Freddie Adu in the U.S. when Adu was an 8-year-old recently arrived from Ghana.
He's 14 years old. He finished school a week ago. That's all you need to know. He's thrilled. He's on summer vacation, and he's getting to play soccer every day and PlayStation in the evening. I'm not sure what more a 14-year-old would want. Plus, he's home for the first time in 2.5 years and gets to eat mom's cooking every day.
That might sound like a most excellent adventure indeed, except that like any other pro athlete, Freddie Adu will be expected to perform. In signing him to a contract that will pay him $500,000 a year, more than any of his teammates, the management of D.C. United is betting not only that this extraordinary 14-year-old can score against this country's most accomplished players, but that he can survive the physical punishment he's likely to encounter as a kid with a reputation for making defenders look foolish and slow. As the practice wound down, D.C. United president and CEO Kevin Payne was asked if he's worried that Freddie, who's already been fouled repeatedly in international play, will be a target this afternoon and beyond.
Somebody asked me if we were going to kind of assign any one player to look after him, and I said no, because we would trust any one of the players in our locker room to look after him, and for that reason we don't have to assign one guy to look after him. We know they all will.
Kevin Payne has seen enough of Freddie Adu's play to be confident that Adu is in fact ready for the big leagues. He's been especially impressed by the youngster's footwork, which has encouraged some to compare Adu to Pele, a comparison Pele himself has endorsed. Payne also credits Adu with more spontaneity, more imagination, and a greater sense of how to read the game than most older players possess. And, Payne reports, Freddie has helped business.
Well, there's no question that Freddie's had a tremendous impact already on ticket sales and the other commercial ends of our business. We all want to be very careful not to overwhelm him. One of the things that we've all committed to is that we're going to make sure that he gets plenty of time to be a kid, hang out with his friends, you know, do whatever it is he wants to do after training. But, you know, obviously he's going to make appearances the same as all the rest of our players with our charitable programs and media appearances and so forth. And we'll try to be careful with the number of commercial appearances that he does.
It might be argued that any number of commercial appearances would be excessive for a 14-year-old, but don't try telling that to Nike. Freddie, like Tiger and LeBron, is on board the swoosh gravy train. And like his elders, he's not lacking in confidence. In a press conference following Wednesday's practice, he said he had no fears.
I don't have, really. I don't try not to think of it like that, you know? You got to have positive thoughts all the time. That's the only way you're going to succeed and the only way you're going to get better. So I don't think like that, and I don't want to think like that. So as of right now, I tell you, nothing.
The man in charge of Freddy Adu's rookie season is a rookie himself, at least as far as coaching is concerned. Peter Nowak, who turned pro as a player in Poland when he was only 15, will try to restore some of the shine to the franchise that dominated Major League Soccer when the league began. At Wednesday's press conference, it was apparent that Nowak felt his greatest challenge might be convincing the team's fans that signing the most talented 14-year-old player in the world wouldn't necessarily make United an instant champion, though he couldn't contain his own enthusiasm.
It's not like really things will happen overnight, but you still have a feeling when Freddie touched the ball, even the practice stuff, what he's doing, then you start to be getting up and say, what's going to happen next? And this is the stuff make all people excited. And then, you know, as far as how many goals, assists, who knows? Everything on the paper looks the same. And then the field is going to, you know, tell you everything. And then next Saturday is the first game. Then it's going to tell you that he's very special because he is.
This afternoon's game between D.C. United and the San Jose Earthquakes is sold out. Nearly 25,000 fans will watch Freddy Adu's debut in person. Elsewhere on Major League Soccer's opening day, the Metro Stars will face the Crew in Columbus. Chicago will visit the Wizards in Kansas City. The Dallas Burn will host Colorado, and the New England Revolution and the Galaxy will play in Los Angeles. It's 18 minutes past the hour. In Day's Lock in Little Wittenham, Oxfordshire, contestants have been at Poo Sticks once again. Poo Sticks, a competition invented by A.A. Milne in his Winnie the Pooh books, consists of several people, or several lovable stuffed animals, dropping sticks into a river and then seeing which stick first crosses the finish line. Folks in Day's Lock have been running the event for 21 years to raise money for charity. Teams from Eastern Europe and from Latin America won medals this time around. Poo Sticks organizer David Caswell characterizes the game as, quote, embracing all age groups. And last weekend's competition proved him correct. One of the winners was Mimi Morley Isat of Oxford. She's 14 months old. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, 30 years ago, Hank Aaron hit home run number 715. A new book commemorates that achievement and its architect. But first, the fond hope of many that the New York Yankees would go 0-162 this season evaporated when the Yanks beat the Devil Rays in Game 2 of their series in Tokyo. That disappointment notwithstanding, it's about time for the rest of Major League Baseball's teams to begin playing games that count. Which means it's also time once again to talk to Tim Kirkchian of ESPN and ESPN the Magazine. Hi, Tim.
Bill, you should just be happy the Yankees didn't go 162-0.
Well, I guess they still could go 161-1.
Unlikely, but you never know.
Perhaps the most overlooked team in the off-season speculation was the world champion Florida Marlins. Their second world title in 6 years surprised lots of people. Do they have any chance to repeat?
I think they have a chance. I think the last two seasons have proven to everyone in baseball that almost any team has a chance. But the problem with the Marlins is, A, they lost a lot of people, including Pudge Rodriguez in the off-season, and B, the Philadelphia Phillies in their division have gotten demonstrably better in the off-season. Especially in their bullpen. So it's amazing to me how little talk there was this spring about the Marlins. It was all about the Phillies and another team in that division, the Braves, how much the Braves have lost, but very little talk about the Marlins.
What about the Cubs? They lost to the Marlins in the NLCS last year. I'm tempted to say the Cubs are as strong as ever, except Mark Pryor is not as strong as ever, their pitcher who's injured. But do the Cubs have another shot?
The Cubs have another shot, Bill. A lot of it depends on Mark Pryor. To me, he's the best pitcher in the National League. And if he's 100% healthy for most of this season, I think the Cubs might be the team to beat, certainly the team to beat in their division, and could be the team to beat in that entire National League. That's how good their starting pitching is. They have the best rotation in baseball. The Cubs, Bill, the best rotation in baseball.
I'm glad you said it twice, because it may not have gotten through.
Since I've been alive, and I'm 47 years old, believe me. So, but again, it all depends on Mark Pryor, who is going to start the season on the disabled list and probably won't pitch until May 1st at the earliest, and it's possible he won't be 100% until June, and the longer he goes, the better the chances of the Houston Astros coming up and winning that division.
Tim, for the sake of perversity, how do you like the possibility that the Baltimore Orioles and the Toronto Blue Jays both finish ahead of both the Red Sox and the Yankees?
There's absolutely no way that can happen. Even though I said earlier anything can happen, I just think the Yankees and the Red Sox are too good. And as much as I like what the Blue Jays have done in the offseason, as much as I love what the Orioles have done in the offseason, they still don't pitch enough to beat either one of those teams. And I think despite all the changes in the division, we might see the exact same finish in the division perhaps for the seventh year in a row.
The Angels, the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Orioles all spent an awful lot of money in the offseason. Does that translate into a World Series appearance, or is there a kind of bargain basement club that you look to see sneaking in there?
You know, Bill, there's a real danger in picking a bargain basement club in case that team that lost 90 games last year loses 95 this year and you pick them to go to the World Series. Well, I don't see that team out there. Now, I could see, for instance, the Padres making a big move. I could see the Royals going to the playoffs. I could see the Diamondbacks not picked everywhere to win the division, winning the division. But I just can't see a team coming out of nowhere and going to the playoffs. It's happened 2 years in a row, but I don't see it. I see the teams that spent an awful lot of money in the offseason being pretty darn good this year.
So it sounds like you're saying that spending an awful lot of money is still a pretty good idea if you want to develop a contending team.
Well, I am. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you can't win without spending a lot. The A's have proven it. The Marlins proved it last year. The Angels 2 years ago. However, what the Red Sox did with their money makes them significantly better. What the Yankees did with their money makes them very formidable. The Angels spending all that money has taken them, for me at least, from third in that division to first in that division. The Phillies have, I think, pretty much put themselves clearly as the team to beat in their division with all the money that they spent. So we can talk all we want about small market and big market and their little teams that go a long way. But in the end, the teams that spend the most money generally win, and I think that will prove out this year.
All right, Tim, I've stayed away from this topic for as long as I could, but the hottest topic in Major League Baseball when spring training began was the same hottest topic as when the World Series ended, and that's steroids. Does this story overshadow everything this season?
No. It puts a black cloud over the game. It's going to be a very uneasy season. We're going to see some very unpleasant things this season, including maybe a star or two getting busted publicly. But it's not going to ruin the game. I refuse to believe, with all the great stories that we've already talked about today and dozens more out there, that the game can be ruined by something like this. Is this a problem? Of course it is. Is it as big as some people make it out to be? Maybe not. But I do know this. The game is going in the right direction on this front because I spent a lot of time in spring training, and the players I saw are getting smaller, Bill. They're not getting bigger, and that is at least a sign that on a small level, this drug policy is starting to work. It needs to be stronger, but at least it's going in the right direction.
One particular player, Barry Bonds, is about ready to move past Willie Mays into third place on the all-time home run list. Is he getting smaller?
I think he is getting smaller, and I don't think it's affecting his power in any way. I think everyone still needs to understand how unbelievably skilled this guy is. He's going to pass Willie Mays probably in the first week of the season. He's going to pass Babe Ruth next year, and the year after that he's going to pass Hank Aaron, and then he's going to retire, and then we'll see where the steroid controversy is then, and then see if any alterations in the record book have to be done. For now, I say let's not touch anything until we get a little bit more proof on what's going on.
Tim Kirchen covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine, and of course he's a regular baseball analyst here with Only a Game. Tim, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill.
Hot dogs, pizza, peanuts and beer, screaming voices in my ear. I've been waiting since last year. Say hey, it's opening day.
Outfielder Adam Hizdu's goal this season was to finally make a big league opening day roster after 14 years of failing to do so. Although he's raised his batting average to just over 200, word from training camp is that the 32-year-old outfielder and audio journalist will be assigned to play for Boston's AAA affiliate, the Pawtucket Red Sox, this season. Next week, we'll meet with Hizdu and find out more about his future in baseball and beyond.
Statistics are flying like the wind. The ump yells, play begins. Nothing matters long as we win. Say hey, it's opening day.
Pitch by Downing. Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It's gone. It's 7-15. There's a new home run champion of all time, and it's Henry Aaron.
Thursday will mark the 30th anniversary of the home run Henry Aaron hit to break Babe Ruth's career record. Aaron did not stop at number 715, of course. He ended his career in 1976 with 755 dingers. But number 715 gave Aaron the record people had long felt nobody would break. Tom Stanton's new book, Hank Aaron and the Home Run That Changed America, recounts the story of Aaron's pursuit of the ghost of Babe Ruth and the reactions that Aaron encountered. Tom Stanton joins me now from member station WDET in Detroit. Tom, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill, it's great to be with you.
These days, every baseball achievement is celebrated and memorialized. Significant home run balls bring fantastic prices on eBay minutes after somebody catches them, and they inspire lengthy lawsuits if it doesn't work out that way. It wasn't like that 30 years ago, though.
No, this experience for Hank Aaron wasn't celebratory at all. It wasn't what we experience now when McGuire or Bonds breaks a record. It was a very sad, disturbing experience. Hank Aaron endured more than anybody other than Jackie Robinson had in terms of the hatred that was directed his way. And when he finally broke the record, he just nonchalantly ran the bases as the crowd was going absolutely wild. And when he finally got up to the microphone afterwards to acknowledge the audience, what he said was very telling. He said, "Thank God, it's over." Hmm. And that kind of sums up what the experience was like for him.
You write about the hate mail and the death threats that Aaron received. To what extent was that mail simply racist, and to what extent was it from folks who just revered Babe Ruth and were afraid that Ruth would disappear if the record were broken?
You know, it was some of both, and it's difficult to separate what was what at this stage. And I think people did fear that some of Ruth was going to disappear if his prime record disappeared. Then there was the other element that was people who were threatening Aaron's life. I mean, there were threats that covered every series that he played in the 73 season. And the threats were so serious that the FBI had agents at the college that his daughter attended, disguised as maintenance people, watching over her to prevent her abduction. The Braves kept him at a hideaway in spring training, separate from the team. They hired bodyguards to watch over him. Friends told me that when they'd go out with Aaron after a game for a burger and a beer, that they sometimes would be armed, that they would be carrying weapons to deal with the situation should it arise. It's just horrendous. It's difficult to imagine these 30-some years later. If you recall the image, when he hits that home run, that 715th home run, and he comes across the plate, there's this this picture of his mother giving him this huge bear hug of an embrace. And most people think that's an exuberant hug, but what it is actually she was hearing the cannons that were firing in the outfield as part of the celebration. She thought her son was being shot at, and she was out there putting her body between him and the bullets that she presumed were coming his way.
Bowie Kuhn, who was the commissioner of baseball in 1974, comes across as a buffoon in your book. He has so little sense of public relations and no manners at all. It would be funny if it weren't so sad. Or was there something more ominous operating there?
I don't think he's a racist. I want to get that out. I don't think that is the case. But he certainly did have a series of missteps that ruined his relationship with Hank Aaron, I believe. You know, it started early in the season when there was a story that appeared in one of the newspapers where somebody had asked a series of pitchers whether or not they'd mind giving up the record-breaking home run. And most of them said, oh, no, we're going to feed him a pitch. We're going to pass one right over the center of the plate. And, it was kind of locker room humor. You know, you'd think you'd be able to read that into it because these guys are all very competitive. But the commissioner responded as if the integrity of the game were on the line, and he threatened to fine any pitcher who gave anything but his absolute best when facing Henry Aaron. And so that was sort of the start of the early in the 73 season, and then it progressed with Bowie Kuhn failing to send a telegram or give Aaron a call after he hit his 700th home run of his career. And when questioned about it, he didn't just simply apologize and acknowledge that he forgot to do it. He tried to explain it away. He told Aaron, in fact, that, well, you know, if I start sending telegrams every time somebody has an achievement, well, pretty soon I'm going to be sending them every time somebody gets three doubles in a game.
Yeah, it might be safe to assume that 700 home runs was a little more significant than most achievements anybody might be about to achieve.
You would think so, but he just kind of mishandled that. And it looked as if things were going to get better between Aaron and Bowie Kuhn. Kuhn had asked Aaron to come throw out the first pitch at the World Series game in 73. But as you recall, Aaron made it to 713 home runs at the end of the 1973 season, which gave him a long winter, which to ponder his fate and the future pitches he would receive come the start of the 74 season. And that opened in Cincinnati with the Braves on the road. Now, Atlanta wanted to save that momentous home run for its hometown crowd, but Kuhn insisted that Aaron play, and on his first swing of the season, he hit home run 714. At that point, Braves manager Eddie Matthews absolutely wanted to save that 715th home run for Atlanta, but Kuhn ordered Aaron to play in another game in Cincinnati. He didn't hit a home run. He returned to Atlanta. Kuhn, not wanting to face the boos of the Atlanta audience, ended up in Cleveland at a meeting of the Wahoo Club and missed the most momentous sports event in his tenure as commissioner of baseball.
That 715th home run, which you call the home run that changed America, obviously changed the name and color of the man who was the leading home run hitter, and as you suggest, it may well have changed baseball's attitude, pushed them towards hiring a black manager sooner than that might have happened. In what other ways was that an event that that changed America?
It changed perceptions. It altered perceptions. It shattered prejudices. And one of the stories, I think, that is untold in his quest was the impact it had on children of that generation. As you may recall, in 73, when the first report surfaced about the hate mail he was receiving and the terrible things being directed his way, there was this outpouring of support from kids all across the country. Tens of thousands of children wrote Hank Aaron, and it was because of him that he kept on pursuing this record. He realized that this was about something much more than baseball. It was a simple morality play to a kid watching this transpire. And I think that set the tone. It made it easier for the popularity of such African-American athletes who would follow, such as Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods. He cleared the way. It was going to take somebody to take that kind of extreme heat. We're not talking about just any record. This was the ultimate record in athletics. I mean, kids grew up who loved baseball knowing that 714 was the home run record. It was a number that you knew. It was not only that, it was Babe Ruth's record, and it was the prime record of America's national pastime. And what better way to alter perceptions and change stereotypes than for a black man to conquer that record?
As Barry Bonds and perhaps Sammy Sosa approach Aaron's career home run record, do you think there will be a new wave of appreciation for what Aaron accomplished?
I think it's inevitable. I know I shouldn't even admit this, but back in 73, my older uncle, who had seen Babe Ruth play, and he used to diminish Aaron compared to Ruth. He's no Babe Ruth, he would tell me. I find myself now looking at Barry Bonds and saying, well, he may break the record, but he's no Hank Aaron. And so I can't help but think that it's going to elevate Hank Aaron's record even further as people want to learn about it and do learn about it inevitably.
Tom Stanton is the author of Hank Aaron and the Home Run That Changed America, published by William Morrow. He joined me from the studios of WDET in Detroit. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you, Bill.
That last home run, last home run. Hank was going some when he hit the last home run. The fan was all on the edge of the seat. The pitcher's heart began to skip a beat when he decided to make that one last throw. Then hammering Hank, he hit that vicious blow. That last home run, last home run. Hank was going some when he hit the last home run. Yesterday, or was it today, when Hank, he wiped over the records away.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a track and field story that doesn't involve illegal substances or speculation regarding athletes partaking thereof. But first, our look at the news of the week with Charlie Pierce, who joins me this week from San Antonio by telephone. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Are you feeling Final Four-ish?
I'm looking out on the Riverwalk at nothing but television sets right now, so.
Let's start with the women's tournament. It continues tomorrow when UConn takes on Minnesota and LSU engages Tennessee. The championship game will be on Tuesday night. The old complaint was that when the men's and women's tournaments overlapped, when they were more or less simultaneous with their finals, nobody noticed the women. Are people more likely to pay attention on Tuesday night?
Well, they're trying everything. It's certainly better than having the women's championship game on the Sunday of the men's championship weekend, which I always thought was a terrible idea, especially since it generally coincided with something around opening day of baseball season, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's another primetime television show, and that may be good enough.
Speaking of women and basketball, at a national slam dunk contest in Houston last weekend, Candace Parker, an exceptionally versatile 6'4" high school senior, out-dunked the most flamboyant male contestants. Does this change everything?
Well, I mean, it's an answer to the overall artistic question, whatever happened to the classics, because Candace is simply dunking the ball, or stuffing the ball, as we used to call it back in the day, whereas she's not doing the, you know, bounce it off the head, bring out the table, jump over the Oldsmobile thing that has sort of like turned the slam dunk contest into a cabaret act. So, yes, I think this was a victory for basketball classicism.
For copyright reasons, Charlie, I will refer to the teams remaining in the men's NCAA tournament as the qualifying quartet. Have you a favorite among the four? Oops, can I say four? I'm not sure about that.
I have a basketball guy's favorite, which is the University of Connecticut, and I also have a rooting favorite, which I suspect will be the University of Connecticut. They've been the best all-around team all season from start to finish. The sentimental favorite, of course, is Oklahoma State with Eddie Sutton, who's sort of gone over what we like to refer to as the Nixon Meridian, that he's passed over the line where people forget about all the really bad stuff he used to do, and he's now sort of a sentimental old guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that come Monday night, the University of Connecticut will beat the surprising Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets for the national championship.
There's another four that we can talk about, Charlie.
And it's frozen.
Yes. Minnesota, Duluth, Denver, Maine, and Boston College meeting in the hockey semifinal games. Thursday this will be. Has college hockey gone as far as it can go in terms of national attention? Is anybody else paying any attention to this?
Well, it's certainly gone as far as it can go in terms of attention in the great state of Minnesota, where it's covered from Minneapolis now to Duluth. And I think it's worth noting that after the really horrific academic scandal around the University of Minnesota men's basketball program a couple of years ago, that the state university system of Minnesota has made itself quite a comeback, because Minnesota Duluth beat the University of Minnesota to qualify.
The NBA standings contain evidence that we're living in a topsy-turvy world there. Miami is fighting for home court advantage in the playoffs, and Portland is trying to avoid being left out of the playoffs. If they are left out, it'll be the first time in 22 years.
Yeah, Portland deliberately took its team apart a little bit because it had a reputation for being the NBA's, you know, most obvious chain gang. So they're going to have to take what they can get. Miami's an interesting story because they really have gelled. I hesitate to bring this up because of my rooting interest in him, but Dwayne Wade, the rookie from Marquette, has been better than they thought he would be. Lamar Odom has straightened out and become a terrific, good-level player. They're going to be a hard team to beat in the playoffs.
Steve Moore, the Colorado Avalanche forward who suffered a broken neck when Todd Bertuzzi mugged him during a game on March 8th, held a news conference on Monday. It's good news that he's up and about, albeit wearing a neck brace, and perhaps good news as well that he doesn't remember what happened to him.
Yeah, and I think there are certain questions that aren't fit for the kind of hurly-burly of a press conference, and have you forgiven him yet is probably right at the top of the list. Because who knows what Steve Moore has in his own mind for Todd Bertuzzi at this point. But you're right. I think it's a measure of how severe this incident was that it's rather like a car accident and stuff with this guy that he doesn't remember it.
In football news, former Green Bay Packer Paul Hornung has been trying to extract his foot from his mouth all week long, having suggested on Tuesday that the Notre Dame football team would only improve when the university relaxed its admission standards so that more black athletes could attend the school. Has he succeeded with this complicated operation involving his foot?
I'm not exactly sure. It was two ideas that should not be associated with each other. It is entirely possible that Notre Dame's academic standards are preventing it from being, Florida State or Miami, but isn't that a good thing? And as far as tangling it up in the whole racial issue, that was an issue that was best left alone, and I think it was handled extremely well by Tyrone Willingham, the head coach of Notre Dame, who said essentially that the remarks were not worthy of comment.
In other football news, Major League Soccer's ninth season begins today with
really? All
eyes, absolutely. Where would you be without me? Anyway, all eyes will be on 14-year-old Freddy Adu playing for DC United. Will you be paying more attention than usual to MLS because of this?
Yes.
Good. Short answer to a long question.
But I don't know exactly the measure of the attention I'll be paying. I think when Freddie comes and plays up near my home, I will be more interested in it than I would be otherwise.
There you go.
But he stepped into the shoes, I think, left behind by LeBron James as overhyped athlete that nobody's ever seen play yet.
We shall see. Meanwhile, the British man who stripped to a thong on the field during the Super Bowl claimed
only
in court
this week.
Only
the second most offensive nude act, by the way, at the Super Bowl this year.
Why did I sort of feel like there might be something to that effect coming? Anyway, this fella claimed in court this week that he shouldn't be punished, and his defense was, nobody told me not to do it. So if this works, this could be a very useful defense for any number of offenses, don't you think?
I was just saying that no, but my parents, my mommy and daddy, and none of the elders and my role models growing up ever told me I shouldn't go to Fort Knox and carry out all the gold that's there.
In baseball news, SBC Park in San Francisco is definitely the place to take in a major league game if you anticipate being bored by that game. The whole stadium is a wireless computer facility now. I wonder if this bespeaks a lack of confidence on the part of the folks running the Giants.
No, but if you think about it, I'll tell you exactly what it bespeaks. It bespeaks the final triumph of the rotisserie nerds, all of whom will be linking up and changing and making trades in the middle of games now.
Of course, of course. In tennis news, Venus Williams was injured and lost at the NASDAQ 100 tournament in Florida this week, but her sister, Serena, dazzled not only with fashion, but with intimidation. I guess she's back.
Yeah, she was pronouncing herself bored a few weeks ago, and she clearly wasn't. She dominated the match so much that her opponent eventually just gave up and handed the racket to the ball person. I'm not using it right now. Why don't you hang on to it for me?
In London, a soccer league has forbidden teams from sending scores to the local newspapers when the games are especially one-sided. I don't know what the theory is here. Maybe that if the score isn't in the paper, the kids on the losing team won't know how badly they lost?
Well, I don't know how closely. Do they have, like, betting pools and stuff on junior soccer and things in England? I don't know how closely the national eye watches youth soccer. But this is you know, a little bit, I think, of creeping Americanism over there in Britain, isn't it?
Maybe so.
You know, that self-esteem triumphs winning and losing?
Finally, Charlie, in the spirit of compassion and economic opportunity, one New Mexico casino recently came up with a solution for those deep in debt. What is that all about?
Apparently, the ad campaign is oriented around the theory of bet your way out of debt. Credit card bills piling up, bring your last 15 cents to our roulette wheel and pay them off. I'm not exactly sure, but this doesn't seem to be in the spirit of the ant and the grasshopper to me.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and it's an excellent bet that he'll join me again at this time next week. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
And somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold, know when to fold.
Track and field is thriving once again in New York City's Washington Heights neighborhood. After an absence of 16 years, the Track and Field Center at the Armory is back with new features, such as the National Track and Field Hall of Fame and a state-of-the-art facility that draws thousands of high school and college runners from around the country. John Kalish reports.
Three floors of interactive exhibits and historical displays comprise the National Track and Field Hall of Fame. The physiology and psychology of the sport are explained in audio, video, and computer presentations.
Before I start the race, the nervousness is making my heart beat fast, and it's making me want to breathe fast, so I have to slow down my breathing.
Sweep, 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 drive, 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 pick them up, pick them up.
Visitors can see the evolution of track apparel and equipment from the 19th century to the present. Among the artifacts on display are a baton from the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, autographed by Jesse Owens, a shot put from 1885 that is sewn together like a baseball, and a stone cube with the word 60 yards chiseled into it.
This is an actual marble block, and if you look at it, it's about a foot tall and a foot wide, and God only knows how much it weighs. And these things used to be on the track, and you'd push off these things, and this was your starting block.
That's Norbert Sander, a New York doctor who heads the nonprofit foundation that runs the Armory. He shows me a bamboo pole that was once used for pole vaulting. And on the way up some stairs leading to a replica of the New York Marathon route, Sander, who actually won the marathon back in 1974, points out a couple of bars suspended from the ceiling.
These two bars that you see are the height of the pole vault world record. One is the woman's record, which is 15. This one was about 15.9. It's going up already. The other one is so far up you can't imagine. It's 20 feet, 1.5 inch. Now, the fellas that installed this came back to me after they put it up there, and they said, I think we made a mistake. I think we mismeasured this thing. Nobody can go that high.
Sander and others on the Armory Foundation raised $20 million to refurbish the facility. On the third floor of the Hall of Fame, there's a 40-foot glass wall on which the names of the inductees have been etched. Across from the wall are several glass doors leading out to a rubber 200-meter bank track built on a raised wooden surface.
The Hall of Fame leads into the track. It's a living Hall of Fame. We've always wanted to have a glass wall that looks in to the competition, and here we have a college meet today. There's literally several thousand runners here. And we look, in a sense, from the past to the future, because here are young college runners who are going to be our stars of tomorrow.
Today, the Armory's state-of-the-art track is considered the busiest indoor facility in the world. But many of the coaches who ran here in their youth remember its sorry decline. In the 1980s, the Armory was turned into a shelter for homeless men, and eventually deteriorated into a stench-filled hall that was a breeding ground for tuberculosis. It was shut down and then reopened in 1993, thanks to the efforts of Dr. Sander and others. Mark Mendez has been track coach at Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan for nearly 30 years. He remembers the Armory before it got a facelift.
used to be a wooden floor. If you fell during a race, you had splinters probably for the next 5 or 6 years.
That's ball court. Come on.
Many people credit the Armory for sparking renewed interest in high school track in the New York area. Several high schools in the city get to practice twice a week here. Murray Bertram High School in Manhattan is among them. Junior Marissa Sylvester runs 200, 400, and 600-meter races. She considers herself lucky to train in the Armory.
It's a special privilege. Everybody don't get to work out here all the time, and one of our school is one of the schools that actually get to practice here. It gives us an advantage. You get to feel the track and stuff. It's a good experience.
It is Heidi McGill of Mountain View coming up the straightaway. She has one lap to go. The national record's 11:49. She has 10:56. The national record is gone in the distance medley.
A number of national high school track records have been shattered this year at the Armory, including the 400-meter girls sprint, girls pole vault, and the 4x200-meter relay. At the Armory in 2001, a student from Virginia named Alan Webb became the first high schooler to run a sub-4-minute mile. Bill Collins is coach of the track team at Highland Regional High School in southern New Jersey, which comes to the Armory several times a year.
The atmosphere is a football game atmosphere, a basketball game atmosphere, but it's a track meet. And these kids aren't used to that. They're usually used to going out and running and nobody even's paying attention. But up here, the announcers know who the runners are. They make it exciting. The crowds get into it. People start cheering. You got music playing. This is an upbeat, energetic area, and we love it.
Sander Norbert says that when athletes compete at the Armory, there are spirits accompanying them.
This building has more track and field in it, in the indoors, than any place in the world. When you run here, you're just not running by yourself. You're running with Tom Courtney, you know, at your elbow, and you're jumping right alongside Bob Beamon. And, you know, it's more than just a track.
In case you're a little rusty on your track and field history, Tom Courtney won 2 gold medals in the 1956 Olympics in the 800-meter and 4x4 events. Bob Beamon won a gold medal in Mexico City and set a world record for long jump in 1968. Courtney competed at the Armory when he was in college. Beamon jumped here when he was in high school. They are among the 197 inductees of the National Track and Field Hall of Fame. This year's inductees are John Carlos, Larry James, Mike Larrabee, and Mary Decker Slaney. The Armory Track and Field Center is already completely booked for the 2004-2005 season. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
On your marks. Set.
Teenage bear, said Uncle Dave, I saw my soul, must be saved. Gonna take a walk down Union Square, you never know. We're gonna find there you gotta run, 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 run. Take the dragon too. Run, 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 run. Jibs the death of you. Hey, what to do?
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Carol Beach. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Hank Aaron and the home run that changed America, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from 14-year-old football phenom Freddie Adu, who says the subject of age has come up amongst his D.C. United teammates, most of whom are in their 20s.
They always make fun of me for being so young, and I make fun of them for being old.
That's a lot like what goes on around here at the Sports Ranch, except... the other way around. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Run, 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 run. Take the dagger too. Run, 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 run. Jibs the death in you. Say what to do.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.